Some of you may have noticed a trend in my reading to you lately, and that, unless you happen to share exactly my reading habits, you probably haven't heard of some of the authors I've been reading. And that's okay, because what happens is this. I will stumble across somebody new and get very giddy and dash to the microphone in my excitement to share him or her with you, and I get started and then have to stop and calm down because it's really very hard to keep the eyes moving across the page and the mouth moving at the same time. So I'll stop and take a few deep breaths and maybe have a beer and calm down. And there are 2 points here. One, I will be back to reading the authors you know very soon, but I'm on cake. And two, tonight's story had me exceptionally giddy, and I had to do more than take a few yoga breaths to calm down. I had to scrape myself off the ceiling. So consider yourselves warned and strap yourself in tight. Good evening. It's Wednesday, the 14th of March, 2007, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. Love in the Winter by Daniel Curley. Look, Ross Taylor said, when at last Grace Martin was really in his car. Instead of dropping off at the station, why don't you ride overland with me, as far as Albany or Syracuse, and take your train on from there? He hesitated, appalled at the traps opening out of the simplest words. The Berkshires will be worth seeing in all this snow. The Mohawk Trail, the Taconic Trail and all, he concluded, lamely. He was glad to have got out of that corner without basing his appeal on some assumption either of his overwhelming personal magnetism or of his pathetic loneliness. It will make the trip more pleasant for you, for me, for both of us. I was hoping you'd say something like that, Grace said. Taylor had been writing the dialogue in his head for the past 3 days, ever since they agreed it would be convenient for Grace to drive to the station with him when he left to go back to Chicago. He had written that very speech for her, in fact, but now that he had actually heard her speaking it, he felt like a vast jellyfish from his throat to his hips. There was a lot he was supposed to say now, but he forgot it all. Good, he said. Good. Fortunately, Grace had a great many things to say about sending a telegram to excuse her change of plans, and he had to make a great many replies that didn't need thinking about. So shaken was he, however, by the success of his opening move, and even more by his audacity in making it at all, that he found himself unable to concentrate on the next move in his campaign. His mind jumped from one irrelevancy to another, but kept returning to simple wonder that she was there at all. Why, 4 days ago, before he had even met her, he despised her. It wasn't enough that she was to be in the Harris's guest room so that he would have to bed down in the study. No, indeed, she had to be a dean of women on top of that. And Taylor was full of the traditional academic contempt for administrators. Of course, he hadn't had much to do with deans of women in recent years, but he remembered the breed well from his days as a young instructor jumping from hick school to hick school. Probably the one where she was dean was just like the lot of them. His first look at her had shaken him, but he steadied himself while he took off his coat and greeted the Harrises, watching her all the while. She didn't look like a dean of women. That was hard to forgive. In fact, she didn't look like an old school chum of Jean Harris. Obviously, as a spinster dean, she had been able to take care of herself. He compared her quickly with Jean, who was iron grey and almost a nervous wreck, and with his own wife, who was now built like the Hollywood version of a Russian lady truck driver. As he moved closer, he saw that she had black hair and light eyes, a combination that never failed to move him profoundly. He was profoundly moved, and despised her the more bitterly for it. By the time the house had quieted down, however, and he lay on the couch in the study, it was really very comfortable. Enjoying a last cigarette, He had so far changed his mind that he was wondering what would happen if tomorrow he found an opportunity to make her one of the vile proposals that had been running through his mind all evening from the very moment they shook hands and their eyes met, and she opened with something other than the standard Dean of Women's Gambit. "We'll get along fine. After all, we're in the same game." He had been ready for that, but it didn't come. And he soon realized that she was quite incapable of it. At the same time, she was only politely interested in how his paper had gone at the Modern Languages Convention that day, and didn't pretend ever to have heard of the Finsberg fragment or any problems connected with it. She didn't even pretend to be interested. All this without leaving the least doubt that she was very much interested in him. Before he finally fell asleep that night, he even went so far as to wonder what would happen if he had the courage then and there to pad on bare feet through the dark house and quietly try the knob of the guest room door. He told himself that he read too many dirty books. He reminded himself of the sanctity of his host's house. He reminded himself of his wife and children. He assured himself that he wasn't that kind of man. In short, he did nothing, neither that night nor the two following nights. Each day he assured himself that he would make a move if he again caught that look that seemed to enter him like an enormous jolt of neat whiskey and explode into fire inside him. Each day he caught the look, but did nothing. Well, not exactly nothing. He did check train and plane schedules and find that if she would agree to give up going by way of New York for the sake of seeing some old friends for a few hours between trains, and if she would agree to drive with him as far as Albany, that they could manage a night in Albany if she would agree to all that. He had it all worked out, but he didn't believe for a minute that he would ever be able to ask her. And now it was done. They were actually driving together through the snow across Massachusetts. Of course, there were still uncertainties, but if he was careful, everything would lead where he wanted to go. His heart pounded at the mere idea of closing a hotel room door on himself and a strange woman. Unfortunately, he could only see as far as that gesture, and he had no idea what came next. It was like a honeymoon, of course, but he had never had a honeymoon. How many people get over those first minutes alone? How long or how short is it before you can say, "For God's sake, let's get to bed"? Probably, since they both know why they were there, it would work out all right, but in his imagination he remained all night with his hand on the doorknob. With his wife, he had never had to confront that problem. It had already been taken care of before they were even introduced. They had waked up in bed together after a party, very publicly compromised. In fact, it was their host's pounding on the bedroom door that awoke them. Their host and hostess had not slept well on the living room couches and were not disposed to let anyone else sleep, especially in their own bed, especially people who, no matter what éclat they had been given the party, had caused all kinds of complications by locking themselves in with all the hats and coats. During the following week, Taylor was at some pains to find the name of the girl. His host and hostess wouldn't speak to him. But when he found her, she wouldn't speak to him either. At last, she consented to a meeting in a public place. One meeting led to another. Taylor began with apology and ended with the offer of his sacred treasure. She hesitated, and Taylor's fate hung in the balance for weeks. Why, she scarcely knew him. And all the while, they continued to see each other in public places. Taylor was secretly horrified at what had happened, and at the same time, he was secretly delighted. In later years, however, the emotion that drove out all others was regret. Regret that he had found the girl and that she had married him, thereby causing him to lose a precious secret that he might otherwise have held with warm pleasure and consolation in marriage with someone else. And regret that all the people who had been at that party had long ago drifted out of his life, and there was now no one to keep the legend alive. Today, with Grace, was going to be more like the beginning of a honeymoon, for all day there would be anticipation while they drove together intimately through the snow. The words, "a night of love," hung in the air before him, as solid as if cut out of stone, as brilliant as if floodlighted on a marquee. The snow continued to fall all day, but the roads were still good. The car was heavy, and the snow treads gave good traction, even in the Berkshires. However, everything was taking longer than Taylor had planned. Never had one of those tiny New England states seemed so endless, and it was well after 2 o'clock when they finally stopped for lunch in Williamstown. They would still get into Albany early enough, but the sense of leisure was being eaten away, and a familiar tension was building up in the back of Taylor's neck. As soon as they left Williamstown and began climbing the Taconic Trail, Taylor began to be on the lookout for the state line. Not the least of the incidental pleasures of the day was the very knowledge that he would be violating the Mann Act. The very thought that he, Ross Taylor, for God's sake, was transporting a woman across a state line for immoral purposes in full defiance of the federal government and the Seventh Commandment, at the risk of his loving wife, his gratifying children, his flourishing career, that terrible thought was delicious indeed. He knew they must be getting close to the line, and he was preparing a light speech about the Mann Act to give himself yet another frisson when she said suddenly, "What's that up ahead?" Engrossed in his fantasy, he had been aware only of the immediate problems of driving, but now he saw two cars standing in the road just about where he imagined the line to be. He automatically slowed and shifted down into second, so as not to lose his traction on the hill. "Looks like an accident," he said. "Oh, I hope not," she said. "I hope no one's hurt." By then they were close enough to see better. "No," he said, "it's not an accident. The New York ploughs haven't come this far, and those cars are stuck." "Do you think we could help them?" she said. "Not likely," he said. "I'm going to go on through, and we can leave word for the state police at the first town we come to." "Do you think we should stop and say we'll send help?" His neck was now so stiff that he didn't expect ever to be able to move his head again. "I don't want to lose my momentum," he said, making an effort to control his temper. After all, she wasn't his wife, even if she did sound like a wife the way she was asking the questions he had resolved not to think about. He made a further effort. "The top of the trail is just beyond the state line. You can see it from here. Up at that bend, where the wind has swept the road bare. It's downhill from there. I think we'll be all right." "I'm sure we will." Just hearing that was almost reward enough in itself. He had forgotten, if ever he knew, how good it is for a man to hear such things. However, he was by no means sure himself that they would get through, but he knew that their schedule was already so badly out of order that it couldn't stand much more delay. "We'll be all right," he said again, as they left behind the ploughed roads and entered the rutted snow of New York State. She said, "My mother always maintained that she could tell the minute she left Massachusetts, but I never believed it until now." He laughed, because just then he was forging past the first of the stock cars. It was a Model A, and was sitting squarely on the road. It hadn't got far, and he would have thought it could be backed out without much trouble. He glanced at the driver, an old woman in a fur coat and fur cap, who smiled at him and waved him on and blew her horn in encouragement as he went past. The second car was almost at right angles to the road, with its rear end against the snowbank at the left. There was room for him to pass, but he was afraid for a minute his wheels were going to start to spin on him as he edged over off the crown of the road, but he shifted down into first and kept going. Both his shoulders ached now, but he was very conscious of his skill in keeping his wheels under him. "Won't be long now," he said, thinking, as he said it, only of getting over the mountain, but realizing at once that it might be considered a crude illusion. He hoped she knew he couldn't do a thing like that. Yes, or she wouldn't be with him at all. Then he hit a snowdrift. The car would move neither forward nor back with all his skill. "I guess that's it," he said, and immediately the tension began to be less. "We can be warm here a long time with the heater, and we have the radio if we get bored with each other's company." He flicked the radio on to demonstrate. "Bored already?" she said. "Nothing but football," he grunted. Being a husband for 20 years had at least taught him some arts of silence. "Let's listen to a game for a little," she said. "I don't really feel it's New Year's until I hear a touchdown or two." "Any preference?" "Rose Bowl, of course," she said. "It's more like Santa Claus." She was disappointed, however, to find that Alabama was being beaten in the Rose Bowl. "They're supposed to win," she said. "The Rose Bowl jinx." They listened for what seemed like a long time. Each time he leaned forward to adjust the radio, he was conscious of her nearness. Each time he lit his cigarette. The football game did not exist for him. During a timeout, she said, "Do you think using the radio like this will run down the battery too much?" "No, it's all right." He knew he had been a little curt. His wife would have noticed it anyway, so he added with some effort, "Running the motor like this is keeping the battery up." He wasn't sure about that, but he hoped so anyway. "Perhaps we shouldn't be running the motor so much." "There's plenty of gas," he said. "I filled it at Williamstown." "I mean, how about carbon monoxide and all that? I don't think the school would care to have its dean of women found in a parked car on a lonely mountain road." "It would teach the girls always to be sure a window is open a bit. You'd be a martyr for education." She laughed, and he felt repaid for the effort, which had been considerable. "Besides," she said, "it's not really so lonely, not with them." She gestured towards the other cars, but Taylor knew it was the nearer she meant, about 20 yards back down the slope. That car and Taylor's car were both slewed across the highway so that they were at right angles to each other. A man and a woman sat stiffly on the front seat, staring through the windshield as if Taylor's car was something in a movie. If it had not been for those spectators, Taylor would have felt obliged to consider whether this was the time to make his pass. But even so, the light was beginning to fail. The tension in his shoulders was returning. He peered up and down the trail to see if any help was in sight. "Here comes more company," he said, "and by the looks of things he won't get far." The car he was watching made a fast run up to the unploughed road and plunged in without slackening speed. "I hope he doesn't chew us up bulling around like that." The car got past the Model A without trouble, but immediately afterward it began to slow so that to get past the second car it had to slow down noticeably. Once it was passed, the driver tramped on the gas and his wheels began to spin. Very shortly, he was squarely across the road just behind Taylor's car. "Well," Taylor said, "that is more like it. I saw that car being worked on when we stopped for gas in Williamstown. Some college boys on their way back to school rammed a bus and smashed in their grill and radiator. Alabama, too, by the way. Looks like a bad day for Alabama all round. But now there'll be plenty of manpower to help get us out of here. According to the mechanic, there are supposed to be 6 of them. You aren't going to do anything rash, are you? Grace said. Good Lord, he said. Rash? What do you mean? He would have known very well what his wife meant, and he was more than a little dismayed by the intimation that even if he was only borrowed for the night, he was to be maintained in good condition. Before she had a chance to answer, the car was surrounded by boys. Taylor rolled down the window to speak to them. "Afternoon, sir," the nearest boy said. "We thought we'd get organized and get all 4 cars out of here. We'll start with the first car down the hill. That will give us a better chance to horse the others around as we come down, right? Are you with us?" "Right," Taylor said, and began to roll up his window. "Just a minute," Grace said. She leaned across Taylor to speak out the window. The boys crowded around for a good look at her. "What my husband means," she said. Taylor was struck dumb and motionless at that, and she was leaning negligently on his knee besides, her hair brushing his cheek. "What he means is that he's with you in spirit, but the fact is that he's ruptured and can't quite do that sort of work, no matter how much he'd like to. You see how it is." "Sure," said one of the boys who had not spoken before. "That's tough," said another. "Of course," said the one who had been spokesman, and whom Taylor had privately labelled fraternity president. "Can we count on you to drive, sir, if we need you? That is, while the rest of us push." "Absolutely," Grace said, quickly sensing that Taylor wasn't going to reply. Taylor, in fact, had not heard the question. He was no longer even aware that he was being smothered by her perfume, her hair, her soft weight against him, a death which he had been contemplating with delight all day up to that very moment. He was not aware of his surroundings even when she had rolled up the window and withdrawn. "I'm sorry," she said, touching his sleeve. "It's all right," he said automatically. He also performed the gesture of patting her hand without having to return to the full unpleasantness of consciousness. "I didn't want you to do that," she said. "I knew it would hurt you. As if you needed to prove anything to those kids." "No, it's really all right, Betty," he said, making an effort to reassure her and turning toward her. He felt as if he had run into something in the dark when he saw that it was not actually his wife who was reading his wife's lines. He remembered vividly that he had called her by his wife's name. "That's done it," he said. "What?" she said. "On top of everything else, calling you by the wrong name." "Don't think about it," she said. "In fact, under the circumstances, it might even be sort of a compliment, but I really don't mind anyway." "I'm the one who owes you an apology." "No, no," he said. He had withdrawn from her as far as possible. "You did absolutely the right thing. I shouldn't have forced you to do it. It was nothing but my vanity. You were right about that. And men laugh at women for dressing to please other women," she said. He could tell she would have laughed if he had been able to give her the least encouragement. "What does a thing like that matter?" This succeeded in diverting his attention, but probably not as she had intended to divert it. He wanted to ask her how she knew about that old rupture, although he was aware there was only one way she could have heard of it. The whole question of what women talk about among themselves came up before him, and bitterly he faked a quotation he couldn't quite remember. "I had a gossip," he said, "and one friend more, that if my husband had but pissed against a wall, I would have run to tell them all of it. "Well," she said, "is that the Finsberg fragment?" "No," he said, "it's the wife of Bath, who knew more about men and women than anybody. She had 5 husbands, you know." "It's not very nice to have anybody know," she broke off in some confusion. "When things begin to go wrong," she said, "they just go wrong." "No," he said, "it will still be all right. Why, they've got 1 car out already and are working on the next. We'll be back in Williamstown in an hour, and if we have to stay there, why then, we stay there and leave for Albany very early in the morning." He knew he wasn't being very realistic about it, because the Model A had been no trouble at all, but now, with the 2nd car, the boys were already floundering in the snow and showing signs of exhaustion. "We'll see," she said. "I'd rather be in Albany tonight, if possible, though." "We'll do it, barring an act of God," he said. It was very nearly dark when the boys came back to Taylor's car. "Would you mind," the fraternity president said, "if we get into your car to rest a while before we tackle our own car? We don't have a heater." "By all means," Taylor said. "And look, I've got some whiskey in the trunk. Let me get it." "We wouldn't say no," said one of the boys who had already climbed into the back seat. The moment Taylor stuck his head out the door, the wind whipped off his hat. Before anyone could move a step, the hat had sailed down the road, over the snowbank, and out across the valley. Taylor watched it go until it disappeared far below in the snow and dark. "Beautiful," he said. "The most pleasure I've had from any hat I've ever owned." His ears felt cold at once, but he thought he was behaving very well. Then he realized that none of the boys had been wearing hats all the while. "Let me get that whiskey," he said. When he came back with the whiskey, he found the doors closed and the car full. The Rose Bowl game was on again. The fraternity president was sitting at the wheel. "I thought," the president said, "that you might not mind holding your wife on your lap for a while." "Oh," Taylor said, "no, of course not." "Well, I mind," Grace said. "An old married woman like me doesn't get as many chances as all that to sit on young men's laps. You might have asked me, and so, dear, with your permission." "Or without it, I dare say," Taylor dared say bitterly. "Never," she said, laughing. "Now, if this gentleman will be so kind as to accommodate me." She indicated the boy next to her on the seat. "Speak up, clown," the fraternity president said. "Sure," the boy said. "He says he is honoured, madam," the president said. "Tell him thank you," she said. "Okay," the president said. "Okay," the boy said. "He says he is quite at your convenience." She slid onto the boy's lap, and the president slid from behind the wheel, and Taylor got out of the cold. He passed Grace the full bottle, out of courtesy, of course, but at the same time he knew he would be able to tell if she was cheating on the drink. Part of his pleasure had been based on the idea of plying her with drink. In fact, that was almost as good as the man act. She took the bottle and punished it like a man, and passed it on, neglecting even the delicacy of a cough and a goddamn to the boy on whose lap she was sitting. His face had become suddenly very red against the darkness of her coat, and when he drank he choked and the tears stood in his eyes. He did not omit the goddamn. The president did not drink but passed the bottle into the back seat, and when it came to him again he urged it on Taylor as if the bottle had been his own. The other felt a stab of irritation, and very nearly said, "God damn it, it's my whiskey!" But he felt ultimately that he was obliged to demonstrate, if only to himself, the superiority of his manners. He allowed the president to drink last. "Go Alabama," the president said as he raised the bottle on high. "Go Jinx," the others chorused, as if they had been drilled to it. "It's not too late," the president said. He drank. It was, in fact, much too late. Even Taylor knew it, and he never paid attention to such things as football. "They're our boys," the others said chorally. As the second round of drinks began, Grace gave the "Go Alabama" and was applauded. She asked to be taught an Alabama song and learned with unconvincing difficulty a song that seemed to be mostly about corn liquor and arson. At least, Taylor was unconvinced, although the boys were enchanted. "Let's go, men," the president shouted, and in very short order, Taylor and Grace were alone in the car while the boys bounded through the snow, yelling, "Go, go, go!" "Confess now," Taylor said. "You knew that song." "Of course," she said. "Even my sweet little freshmen know it. They think it's very daring. We encourage them to think so." "Apparently the boys are encouraged to think so too," he said, "but I have never heard it." "Really?" she said. "From the way you were trying to catch my eye, I thought maybe that that song was the Finsburg Fragment." "Now that you mention it, it is very Anglo-Saxon in mood, a getting drunk, boasting, burning down the mead hall sort of thing." "Then what were you trying to catch my eye about?" Taylor had to grope for a moment back to the time when all the boys were in the car. Once they were gone, he had forgotten all the irritation they had caused. It infuriated him now that he was unable to cherish a manly anger, and he said with rather more heat than he had intended, "I thought you were being pretty hard on that kid under you," he said. "I was being hard on him," she said. "That's a laugh." "You couldn't see his face," Taylor said. "He was embarrassed. He was very uncomfortable." "I didn't have to see his face. He was enjoying it all right." "Christ," Taylor said. "The famous feminine intuition never knows a goddamn thing about what a man enjoys or how he enjoys it." "Well, I'll tell you something," she said. "The famous feminine intuition can tell in a minute who was really being given a hard time." "Me," Taylor said. "Don't make me laugh. What's it to me if you want to act like a giddy freshman on her first football weekend?" "I don't know what it is to you, but you sure are making it something." "Look here," Taylor said. He could have gone on as far as, "If you think for 1 minute that," hoping for some inspiration before he ran out of words, but he was saved by shouts from the boys who were having some trouble with their own car. Their car was stopped further down the slope now and backed into the snowbank. The boys were crowding around the back of the car and looking at something that was hidden from Taylor's car. "It looks as if they've hit something," Taylor said. "Perhaps someone is hurt," Grace said. One of the boys was already floundering up toward them, and Grace and Taylor were both out of the car waiting when he got there. "Let me have the whiskey," he panted. Taylor turned to get it. "An accident!" "I'll take it down," Grace said. "I know first aid. Is he badly hurt?" "Don't know," the boy called back over his shoulder as he ran ahead of them down the trail. They found that the car had pushed one of the boys into the snowbank and held him there so that he couldn't move his arms. "Are you in pain?" Grace asked. The boy, who was obviously terrified, shook his head. Grace tried to pass him the bottle, but she couldn't reach him. "Here," one of the boys said. He took the bottle and got into the car and, leaning out the window, held it for the imprisoned boy to drink. He drank as if he were very thirsty, and he did not cough, and only added "God damn" as an unconvincing afterthought. "That's the spirit," Grace said. "Can't you move the car away enough to get him out?" Taylor said. "We don't know where his legs are," the president said. "We're afraid to spin the wheels." "Quite," Taylor said to his own surprise, and he lost track of things for a minute until he realized that Americans he knew didn't get into spots like this, but Englishmen were always doing it in novels and movies. "We're afraid he may be broken up already," the president said in a lowered voice, "but we don't want to upset him any more than he is already." "Just right," Grace said. "How you feeling, boy?" she called. The boy in the snow smiled wanly. One of the others called, "Old horse is resting. He'll take a deep breath in a minute and move it away with his chest." The others laughed very loudly. "All right," the president said, "up on the snowbank and let's dig him out." In 10 minutes they had the boy out and were helping him to stand in the road. They were examining him as if he were something they had just unpacked from a crate that had arrived in bad condition. They moved his arms and legs and watched his face for signs of pain. There seemed to be nothing wrong with him, although he could scarcely stand and didn't respond to any questions. "Old horse is just tired," the president said. Then in a lower voice, but still loud enough for the boys to hear, he said, "He's been working more than any two of the rest. I'll take him up to our car and get him warm," Grace said. "Come along, horse." She took the boy's arm to lead him away, but he shook off her hand and began to follow the car which the other boys were moving down the trail back into Massachusetts. "I hope they come to get us out," Taylor said when he and Grace were back in the warm car. "Of course they will," Grace said. "What an idea." "They're mad I didn't help," Taylor said. "And now this. They'll blame me. You'll see." "That's all in your mind," Grace said. "Look," she said, "I'm sorry about sitting in that kid's lap. I thought I was playing the old married woman to the hilt. I thought it would amuse you. I thought you'd be as pleased with me as I was." "I see," Taylor said. "I didn't see then, but I see now. It's really all right. I just wish I could go back over it again and laugh in the right place." He didn't feel at all like laughing as he began to understand the vast sadness of the gap between his game of the man act and her game of the old married couple. But he did feel a new and very different tenderness toward her. He wondered how much of all that she knew. "I really feel as if we've been married for a long, long time," he said. Then, carried away, he added what he thought for a moment might not be a lie. "I think, really, I was upset at the thought that we hadn't been." "Oh, Ross," she said. She put her hand on his sleeve, but he didn't trust himself to touch her. Not there, not then, not any longer. "It's just too bad," she said. "Please don't touch me," he said. His hands clutched the wheel as they had all day. She withdrew her hand, but was still near him on the seat. Then he heard the boys coming up the trail. He hurriedly put his arm round her shoulders and gave her a gentle squeeze. It really was like squeezing a woman he had been married to for a long, long time. They had been through a lot together, and small signs meant much. When the boys began to appear out of the gloom, he put his hands back on the wheel. "We'll laugh about this sometime," she said. Taylor was glad it was dark, because he wasn't laughing then. He could feel his eyes brimming, and he was afraid the tears would start to shine down his cheeks at any minute. They didn't, not then, and not on the long ride up through a corner of Vermont and down to the Albany station, and not even at the station where she caught the last night's train coming through 6 hours late. And that at least was something. He thought about that day on every New Year's for the rest of his life, and at strange moments in between, but he never once laughed about it.